on your knees. Thank them for living. They've got plans to steal the sun. All you get is what they're giving, and they're looking after number one. So let's give thanks for the scraps that they throw us, for the kindness that they show us, for the freedom they allow us. The other day I thought I heard a voice that said,
things are bad but you'll pull through, just keep your head.
They've got mansions made of marble, they've got guards on every door. Scrape the crumbs from off the table, gotta give a hand out to the poor. So let's give thanks for the scraps that they throw us, for the kindness that they show us, for the freedom they allow us. The other day I thought I heard a voice that said, things could be worse, you're getting sleep, you're getting fed.
All right, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowan. That was the inimitable Leon Rosselson. Let's give thanks. What a more appropriate song can you think of, Sarah?
That was a pretty great one, actually.
That was from his Where Are the Barricades release on PM Press.
Where are they, though? They're going up all over the world. Like barricades, I mean.
Oh, that's exactly. Yeah. It's true. It's true. We are in a time of incredible global action. And I guess we're just so enthralled. We think the impeachment is going to resolve everything, maybe.
Who's we? I don't think the impeachment's going to... You know, impeachment has never resolved anything in America.
Actually, it's interesting. I was reading a history. The New Yorker has a history of impeachment going back to the Magna Carta or something. Very interesting, but we won't get into that today. We're waiting for some guests.
We do. We have a few guests coming in today, I hope. Now, this is the thing. So when you are working with the unhoused community, stuff is sometimes unreliable. They have very little control over their circumstances. So we're going to be patient. We do have plenty to talk about. But we're going to talk about Thanksgiving a little bit today. Thanksgiving on the street. So like, what are your Thanksgiving traditions, and think about how those might change if you lost your home. We're going to talk with folks who deal with that every day and hear the ways that they try to stay connected to family and community during the holidays. And we also want to talk about what Thanksgiving represents and what it attempts to gloss over in a country based on indigenous genocide and land theft. And what honoring those original inhabitants might look like instead.
Yeah, so if there, I know people in the houseless community do listen to the radio, do listen to KBOO. So if you are listening and you have a chance to call in and talk about your, you know, what it means to you, then we'd welcome that. And if you know the people who are supposed to be coming in, let them know that they're...
We started already. I just want to talk first a little bit about the indigenous, the responsibilities that we have as colonizers to indigenous communities at this time of year. And I do think a lot of it is not to romanticize Thanksgiving, and maybe not to romanticize it for our children. I think that's something we should probably be moving out of. So... I think that there's been a lot of very interesting leadership emerging from like indigenous communities in the Northwest lately. We've seen calls from a couple of different tribes to take out the dams on the Columbia River. I think that one of the ways that we can honor the tribes at this time of year is to actually listen to their leadership and follow it. And I'd like that to encourage that, not just for, you know, elected officials and things like that, but those of us who are consider ourselves activists and those of us who are, you know, doing environmental activism, this is the leadership we should be following. So if you're in an organization and all the leaders are white and maybe from England, maybe reconsider and maybe direct your energies towards what the tribes here are asking us to do.
You know, it's interesting that I've got involved very, very deeply with the native fishing rights when I first got to Oregon back in the mid-80s. And there's a whole cycle, yearly cycle of feasts and celebrations. They call them the first foods, the roots, the berries, the salmon, and the deer. And those are definitely Thanksgiving feasts. So it's interesting. I actually haven't read that much about it, but I assume that that probably, you know, the mythical story of Thanksgiving that were handed down, you know, Squanto and all that, the idea that they, and there was something to it. There were events, a series of events that actually did take place where there, you know, colonizers sat down with the colonized to some sort of feast. But I wonder if it actually was directly related to those first foods feasts that seemingly almost all Native people do across the continent. I suspected it did.
Well, yeah, I mean, indigenous cultures have food sharing rituals around harvests, and that is, I mean, that's actually a pretty decent segue into talking about our food sharing rituals and things like that. Because one of the things that we're seeing right now in Portland is that the Parks Department is trying to stop community meals in the parks. And of course, they're posing it as trying to regulate it. So they are imposing requirements for permits, requirements for insurance, things like that, that would be prohibitively expensive for these like tiny groups and sometimes independent people who are trying to keep the folks in Portland who are hungry fed.
Because there are quite a few, actually. I'm surprised just going around the city at different times, downtown, I guess, mainly, but I know other parts of the city, there's a number of different groups that have just sort of taken on that responsibility.
Well, it's not something that the city, the county, or the state really provides. You know, there is the food bank, which does great work, but that if you don't have a place to cook food, that kind of leaves you out of being able to take advantage of boxes of rutabagas and potatoes. You know, also the city does not have any groups that actually work to take those raw foodstuffs and turn them into meals for people.
I know Food Not Bombs has been doing that. But,
oh, Food yeah. Not Bombs and Free Hot Soup and hundreds of independent people, but it's not funded by the city.
Right.
None of this comes from your tax money. However, your tax money does pay for the police that push us out of parks and push people out of their, you know, communities on the street.
So I assume you've been following this story, and so what are the actual reasons they say that they're having to regulate?
It's been very interesting, and there was actually a new development that came up last night. So I'm pleased to talk about this. So the reasoning behind these new regulations seems to admittedly be almost solely directed at the free hot soup service in Director's Park. This is a downtown park. It is very central to a lot of commerce, but it's also very central to the houseless population down there. And there are people who depend on that meal service. And, you know, it was pointed out by somebody I was listening to. There's been a lot of great coverage on this, and I was listening to something the other day, and one of the people who serves at Free Hot Soup pointed out that there are people that come to these meals that don't actually know what day it is until they see our faces over the food, because that's the consistency there. So asking people, you know, the Park Service, just to backtrack, sorry, and answer your question, has indicated that, first of all, that there is mess that is created.
I figured that would be one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, they haven't actually pinned that down because it doesn't seem to be a huge problem, but they did.
I assume there's some cleanup after.
Well, we, you know, the folks that do the work clean up, and they do a really good job of it. What the Park Service indicated is that they have, on one or two occasions, had to send somebody by in the morning to clean up. Now, again, it's a public square in downtown Portland. There's historically been a restaurant in the actual square. Blaming that on one particular social service that occurs in the area is it's kind of a reach. They also have said that there's been interference with other events in the square. Now, if you've ever actually seen the Director's Park food service, you know that they take a tiny corner of the park. They serve on a bench that's built in there, right on the sidewalk. And they usually don't occupy more than a quarter of the square. And they also, you know, are perfectly happy to move outside the square and direct people to where they're going if they're given notice. So there's never really been a conflict with scheduling as far as anybody at Free Huts.
Maybe those folks are just unsightly.
Maybe they are, and maybe they dissuade people who own businesses around there from using the parks, that park, for events for which the city could then charge revenue. so once again, we're seeing that corporations have more say than normal people in the way things work in Portland. This is very reminiscent of... Yeah, it's very reminiscent of when Sorrel asked Ted Wheeler to add more police because their employees were being talked to by homeless people on their way to work. So last night there was a Willamette Week article that came out, and it said that it showed a bunch of emails between the Park Service, Nick Fish's office, and the businesses in the area. And it is exactly what we assumed was the reason. So there are businesses who wish to use the space. They are unhappy that a non-revenue generating entity is using the space. And it just, yeah, once again, does seem to be that profit over people model.
Uh-huh. And I guess they didn't think to use some sort of secret email server for their...
No, I mean, I am really loving, I got to say, both the Willamette Week and the Mercury right now are doing really good work for the people. Like, we need this kind of journalism, like calling out our city leaders and our city processes, because it's very encouraging to see. I'm just, so thanks, y'all.
So I realize that I invited people to call in, but I actually didn't give the phone number.
Oh, Paul.
503-231-8187. And I believe I saw our board op go out to meet somebody, so maybe our guests are here.
Oh, hurrah. So yeah, I've just been really encouraged by the news that's been coming through, because lots of people are working to fight this. I mean, everybody has basically said that they're gonna keep doing what they're doing. We know that people need to be fed regardless of whether or not the city is okay with the way that it's happening, if they're not doing it in another way, and if there are no complaints aside from those business owners, then I don't see a reason for the regulation change. Oh, hi. So we're just gonna resettle a little bit. We've got Christine joining us. I'm gonna let her get a little settled, and then she'll introduce herself. But we're here today to talk about, aside from what we've already been talking about, Thanksgiving and how that might look if you were unhoused. I know that, like, Thanksgiving actually can have a lot of weight for a lot of different reasons. And, you know, the holidays are times where you might get together with your family, or you might not, and there might be some emotional involvement in that for you. I also know that it's a time where people get together with their families and suddenly have to talk about political issues in ways that they're not perhaps comfortable with. And I just, you know, solidarity, you can do it. You can talk to your racist uncle. In fact, you have to. So, Christine, hi, welcome. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us. So, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit?
Hi, I'm Christine, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much. Christine, so what are your plans for Thanksgiving this year? Do you know?
This year I plan on spending it with some friends downtown.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, they got a 20-pound turkey from work.
Nice.
Yeah.
The turkey giveaway is a great thing. I know that we've got a couple that we're going to be giving or serving to people. So there are places all over the city that offer Thanksgiving meals, and I know it's a big volunteer service opportunity for folks, and that's something I actually find kind of interesting. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I do. I think their intentions are amazing. God bless them. They really go out of their way to help a lot of people, but from my perspective, it's really uncomfortable. It's a lot of standing around in the freezing cold rain, and you're rushed in, and by the time the food comes, it's cold, and the coffee's too hot, so you drink that on your way out and look for a bathroom for an hour, and it's just not pleasant. A place to hang out and be warm for a few hours would be a lot more preferable.
That actually makes a lot of sense. I know.
Or hot soup in the park. If you're going to shuffle people through, give them hot soup in the park. It's cold, it's wet, and we're standing around outside a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You sit down for 10 minutes, and they rush you out for the next group.
Yeah. Well, and that always feels bad in any sort of shelter model, like, quite honestly. Even, you know, we run some pretty, like, relaxed shelters, but we still have to ask people to leave in the morning, and that's always... You know, we want to be able to offer actual respite. And it, so I, yeah, on both ends, I figure it's pretty hard to work in that circumstance, you know? I know a lot of people who do outreach work who kind of have their own little Thanksgivings and will, you know, bring the folks that they work closely with to their homes. I know a lot of people who are doing that this year, especially. Because there's been a lot of space lost in the community.
Okay.
We know we've talked about St. Francis Dining Hall shutting down some of their service. Of course, Sunnyside Community Center, where, you know, we did a lot of service, Portland Assembly personally, has closed everything. We're still doing service in the park across the street, but having a place to invite people in and let them be relaxed and warm and play the piano and have their dogs was a lot more preferable. So we're really missing that this year, I would say, having a place to actually bring our community.
Yeah.
So yeah, if anybody listening has stories about what they do at the holidays or, If they've experienced an unhoused Thanksgiving, give us a call. The number is 503-231-8187.
Yeah, this whole issue, I mean, that's something obviously you all, we have talked about a fair amount on this third Wednesday show. The issue of housing, of speculation, of the using of spaces for making profit, speculating on. And it's shocking, and obviously unhoused people see it much more drastically than those of us who are lucky to have a place to live with a roof over our heads. That the access to places to be, to get out of, even if you are living on the streets, it must be incredibly nice, as you're saying, Christine, to have a place where you can get out. And there's and it's going in the wrong direction, it seems like to me.
Well, I mean. Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts personally about the way that money buys you space in this world. And it does actually feel like there's a lot of, you know, we were just talking about protests all over the world right now, uprisings. I wouldn't even call them protests. I think that it's a lot more powerful than that. In Chile, in Iran, all over the world right now. And I do feel that one of the prime conflicts in these is right to space. And because water rights are tied into this, because,
Transportation rights,
selling of natural resources are all tied into these things. That's all the land beneath us, you know? That's what we have. It's an argument over what we have a right to and whether or not capital buys you more right to that. It's interesting because, you know, just to quickly touch on the housing thing, I know we talk about this a lot, but one of the things I keep coming back to is this purse fund thing. And the way that these major corporations, Blackstone, et cetera, are using our money to finance buying our homes away from us. So this displacement is fueled with, in part, our retirement funds because of the decision that Ted Wheeler, as state treasurer, made to put money in our purse funds into these particular large offshore buying pools. So we are giving money to people to buy us out of our homes. And that seems to be, I mean, you know, if we're talking about the foundations of this country and the foundations on stolen land, it seems pretty consistent.
You know, one thing I really appreciate about the way you the my co-hosts Sarah and Jonathan sometimes and have approached this program is to weave together the sort of the big picture that basically creates the conditions in which we, you know, we're forced to deal with things and sort of the on the streets, on the ground realities, which, you know, Christine is here also to talk about, and it's hard to do. But I think that's really important to do. Well, I just wanted, Christine, have you noticed this sort of a change in availability of places? And, you know, obviously places to actually live on a day-to-day basis is one thing, but just where to go, is that, have you noticed that there's a change in that?
Somewhat. I have a husband and a dog. Not every place is pet-friendly. A lot of them are gender-specific. So the places we go as a family are a little bit more limited, but we do okay. A lot of them close early.
There's a lot of shortage of space for families. That's something, so some of you may have seen in the news, something I'm kind of excited about. There was, the day before yesterday, I believe, a group in Oakland called Moms for Housing, took over a bank-owned house that had been sitting empty for two years, and they put two families in it. And I find that incredibly, like, exciting, because we know that we are surrounded by empty bank-owned properties. It's a little different here because a lot of those, there's been an acceleration in development, as you may have noticed, and with all this, like, transportation corridor development, it gives them this chance to really just knock everything down and rebuild. So we see a lot of our bank-owned empty properties in the form of big apartments and condo buildings, so they're a little less visible.
So you're talking like Division Street?
Yeah, exactly. Or I'm thinking about, say, Williams or right. Vancouver over there, where the entire face of the neighborhood has changed. Pretty much nobody that lived there before can afford to live there now. And these areas are actually kind of sparsely populated, which is a weird dichotomy. So I think that we definitely are seeing a sort of just a clearing of space. But in Oakland, you can still see... like you walk down the street and it'll be a house with a family in it, a house with a family in it, and then three empty houses that have been sitting there for literally years. And this is stuff, you know, it still exists in Portland, and we certainly saw a lot of it after 2008. Oh, it looks like we have a caller.
Go ahead. let us know who you are and go ahead and say what you have to say.
It's Suzanne.
Hi, Suzanne.
Salem. Yeah. What I see and what I experience with all of this grandiosity of, you know, giving out food and doing this and that, but what is really at the center of this is that in order to give guilt-free, we have to be worth something from the heart. It has nothing to do with money. And I'll give you an example. I go to a church most of the time. Anyway, I decided they have that peace be with you thing, you know, and everybody holds out a cold handshake. So about the third time I was going to this church, I started hugging people. And the clergy said, well, we've never had so much fun. Since you know, we usually are kind of chilly. And I said, well, if you can discover you that you are chilly, then change your behavior.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, that's something that I was thinking about in regards to folks doing, you know, bringing their families down to the shelter to do Thanksgiving service. And how that
our
might...
Our family used to do that.
Yeah.
But our kids taught us. They said, I don't know these people. Why can't we stay here and talk to them?
Exactly.
And so forth.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for calling, Suzanne.
Yes. I love you all. Happy Thanksgiving.
We love you too. Thanks very much. Yeah, that's actually something I was thinking about last night is we talked before on the show about a concept called abominable fancies, which is a Puritan, like early Christian concept that talks about how people in heaven get to watch the torments of the damned and it's part of their reward. So not only do you get this lofty seat, but you actually... part of your reward is enjoying watching other people suffer. And I think that sometimes if we make service a one day a year thing, we're putting ourselves in that position of watching people suffer rather than actually knowing them. And what Suzanne said that her children asked, which is why can't we stay, is something that I think about a lot. That we're building community. We're not doing charity work. These people are our friends. These people are the people that we live with who ultimately we need to survive. It goes both ways. So for us to do that once a year and consider it enough is kind of like voting once a year and considering yourself politically active. It's not really doing it anymore. So I encourage, you know, folks to use this as a motivator to get them out there really engaging with their communities. And it doesn't have to be giving out food. There are lots and lots of ways to do it.
So I want to remind people, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Rowland, regular host, and got Sarah, a regular third Wednesday co-host, and Christine, a guest in the studio, talking about Thanksgiving and how people who are living without a regular roof over their heads, or at least a house to live in regularly, are dealing with Thanksgiving and holiday situations. Coming up at 9, it's Got Science, where we hear how science makes the world a better place and how scientists are standing up for science in the age of Trump. At 9:30, it's WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service, a program by and about women around the world. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And 11, the food show will give an in-depth look at fermentation and making miso. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you haven't yet done so and would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Also, you can listen to all programs after they air, except for the nationally syndicated ones, by going to kboo.fm. You can find out how to volunteer and get involved with KBOO. The number to call in is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187 to join the conversation.
We'd love to hear from you. So yeah, we're talking about what houseless folks deal with at the holidays. And so let's just talk about sweeps a little in general. One of the things, I've been doing some outreach in neighborhoods and talking to folks about houseless sweeps, housed folks. And there are, I gotta say, a lot of misconceptions. One of the big things that I'm finding that people don't know is that a lot of people who live on the streets have jobs. And I think that this is just, maybe sometimes people who, especially who own homes, are pretty distanced from the economy, I guess, the way that it's working right now and what people are actually being asked to pay in rent. Because I get so many surprised reactions from people who don't recognize that people are threatened by sweeps because they have to leave their things to go to work and they don't have a safe place to keep them. And that's just one of the big misconceptions that I see people having.
So sweeps happen whether or not there's somebody actually occupying the site or not.
Oh yeah, and it's been increasingly confusing, I would say, for folks because there are so many agencies involved in these sweeps at this point. Sweeps will only be posted by police, but we've seen that doesn't actually seem to be bearing out. We've also seen in certain neighborhoods and certain areas that people get swept without any notice. Or the people who are posting have different ideas about the areas that those postings cover. So I have been told by Portland police that a posting covers 2 blocks, say, or 10 blocks. And there's a big difference between 2 and 10 blocks. So it may be that sometimes these agencies think that this camp has already been posted, merely because a camp 6 blocks away was posted. But if the folks who are actually there don't know, then I don't know how that could be considered to be official. And that also leads to the problem that you get back to your camp and your stuff is gone and you don't know where it is.
They don't leave like a notice.
They're supposed to, but I don't really know how consistent that is. And then there's the problem of getting your stuff back. And maybe Christine, do you want to talk about that a little bit? What it's like to go through a sweep?
Well, I've managed to dodge sweeps. I'll be warned like a couple days to a week ahead of time. A lot of times I'm not there and my husband has to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really inconvenient just trying to get some place to eat. I don't like a lot of food at my camp because it will attract rats. I don't even like leaving dog food there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really inconvenient. You need to go charge your phone. You have to get a shower, do your laundry, try to make appointments someplace halfway quiet. And you can't be in 5 places at once.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And just having to move everything again.
Yeah. Well, and it does seem like these sweeps, I know that they're supposed to be motivated by community calls, but we're really noticing that they're just on a schedule now. And I have talked to folks downtown who will have someone come by and tell them that they're going to be swept, and this happens about 3 times a week. And then they will clean their own camp, and then Clean and Safe will come by and take pictures of it. So we should be aware that Clean and Safe and these other agencies are getting paid for work that they're not doing, that the folks who actually live in these camps are doing.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think we have another caller. Caller?
Hello, my name is Harry, and thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Harry.
As for the Thanksgiving Day itself, it was first made a national holiday during the Civil War by President Lincoln. It's more or less for a propaganda stance, you know. But also, so that they had to come up with stories about Thanksgiving. So I think that's why they start going back to history and find out about the Pilgrims, even if it was true or not. We're not sure, but anyway, for us during Thanksgiving, about a month before, we see a lot of commercials on TV about the Union Gospel Mission, and also the Blanchet House. Have you ever been to those two facilities, and do we need some more like that?
The Blanchet House is like a train ride. It just rotates through. You're sitting there for 5 minutes, and you're rushed out. I don't really go there because they're not pet-friendly. The Union Gospel Mission's all right, but again, there you can't just sit there for a couple hours and be warm. That's what we really need. That's what the people really want. Yeah, I mean, hitting five meals on a rainy day is not exactly what I call fun. That's not what I need.
Yeah.
One meal and a place to be warm would be great.
So I feel like maybe the answer is that we need more of everything. If we need people to be able to access housing and decide for themselves what they want to do with their holidays.
Sustainable housing, and that's not happening in apartments.
Oh, okay. What do you think of in Seattle? They have eight government-run tent cities. Portland only has one, Dignity Village, but if you go to it right now, they have a 30-day waiting period. So we don't have any tent cities. What do you think of the idea of the city of Portland making tent cities?
We love the idea of allowing people to access land to live the way they want. So we have a number of tiny house villages in Portland that have been built on different types of land. So some of them are on church property, some of them are on ODOT property or public land. And we love the idea of opening up more public land, more ODOT land, more city land for
tiny house villages. They seem to be working fairly successfully. Yeah.
They are very successful. This is something, so, I mean, Ibrahim Murbach, who runs Right to Survive, has a show on Monday nights, but he talks about this, that he goes all over the country and talks about the models that we have here to folks in other cities. I want to stress that these are not city or government run. These are peer run. So these are self-directed camps. They are built and run and operated by the folks who live in them. And that has been the model that seems to work the best and be the most sustainable. It's not that folks are coming in and saying, here are the resources that we've been given to allot to you. It's just that we stop standing between people and access to a place to live.
Of course, the problem is you're fighting against these current that you keep talking about, the global capitalist system and the closing of all, not just public spaces, but private spaces by this inexorable process of speculating on space and basically leaving spaces vacant so people can speculate them, which dries up all the so many of the possibilities. I mean, you're basically going against the current. It is.
And we see the social ramifications of that in the stuff that Christine's talking about, that you can't just go be somewhere, that you can go somewhere for a meal or you can go somewhere for a particular service. But public space is at such a premium that we can't even just enjoy it without paying for it. So like, I know that there are not a lot of cafes in Portland that will let someone hang out there. There are, I mean, what do we have? We have the public library, and I think that's pretty much it. And even that, I know that a lot of libraries have pressure to ask people not to stay that long. And one of the things we keep coming back to is that we need day spaces. We need respite space. We need places for people to be left alone, to be warm, to charge their phones, to have normal conversations with each other, and not to be charged for their time.
Where are those billionaires who think they're helping people out so much? Why don't they buy up a bunch of property and just turn it over to people?
Well, they are really busy shoveling their money out of this economy so that when it crashes...
They're all donating to the big organizations that help people on paper.
Yeah, and that's true too. So we see like the new navigation center. What do we think about that? Do you have any opinions about that one?
I think TPI needs to mind their own business and let Harbor of Hope run their shelters.
Well, let's explain this. I don't know much about this.
Oh, so the Navigation Center is a new shelter that's been built under the Fremont Bridge, over by the yards there in Northwest. I think they have 60 beds. Is that right? Do you know?
I don't know.
But it's a three-month period that you can stay there. And there's a lot of, one of the reasons that we need more peer run, and peer run means that the folks who live there get to make decisions for themselves, spaces, is that there are so many groups that are associated with the city that don't do the best job and really burn folks who live on the streets and have to depend on their services. We come up against this term service resistant, and I find it pretty laughable if you've ever tried to access these services, because I would say that services are actually people resistant. I think that I run into so many folks who have had bad experiences with, you know, Central City Concern or TPI or these groups that run these big shelters, that they are actually scared to go stay in these shelters. And that can go from anywhere from, you know, just not being able to live within the rules. And I don't mean like I can't go to bed when I'm told to, but that if you have a dog, you can't stay there. If you have a spouse, you can't stay together. That sort of dehumanizing policy.
But I would think even like stuff like, I mean, I'm just thinking about this. You know, it's, I confess, I mean, I always lived in a house. And so I'm not forced to think of these things. But, you know, part of the thing in this is, you know, the American dream is, you know, you get your own place and then you can do what you want. But I mean, like, being able to like listen to music, being able to, there's so many things that we take for granted that we can just do on a regular basis that you might want to do, but you can't.
Use your phone to make an appointment without being interrupted.
Yeah, shelters are noisy. It's really hard to like try to give people places to, yeah, have private conversations.
Wake up in the morning, go to the bathroom and get your coffee without having to interact with 1,000 idiots.
That is something that I bet a lot of us take for granted.
The anxiety is horrible.
And you don't know who you're going to encounter. You don't know who you're going to, you know, have to deal with on the way to that coffee. Like, or what state they'll be in. You know, what they will have experienced.
Oh, most of it comes from staff.
Oh, really?
That's where the harassment comes from, is the employees. I have stayed at a shelter that allows us to stay as a family with my husband and my dog. And I'm very thankful for that. I've been out for most of the summer and it's been wonderful. Mm-hmm. And we're finding it necessary to return, even though we're very reluctant. And we're primarily doing it for our 13-year-old beagle.
Yeah, I mean, it's as it gets colder, people have to give up that autonomy, and that's a real struggle, I think, for a lot of folks. I don't know. I think that there's a big disconnect because housed folks don't really understand that that's the big difference, is that you actually have a say in what you do and how you do it. And if you're depending on the shelter system to stay indoors, then you're doing it under, like, by their rules. And that sort of patriarchal, like, enforcement of somebody else's will, like, isn't the way that we expect to live as adults, you know? So we've got a little bit more time here, so if you want to call in and ask questions or tell us your story, the number is 503-231-8187. And we are talking today about Thanksgiving, and kind of the weird fictions that it's built on, and what that means for us today, as far as housing and as far as land rights.
Yeah, I want to go back to that story in Oakland of the people taking over the housing. You know, I remember when I first got back to Portland after many, many years away, it was in the wake of the great, what do they call it, the Great Recession or whatever, and then, you know, Occupy and the sort of the falling out of that, or the legacy of that. And there was a number of occupations, or, well, actually it was mostly people trying to stay in their houses. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But when I was in D.C. just before that, I was involved a little bit in Occupy there, and there were some, you know, occupations of houses going on with the group 1DC. And it seems like there hasn't been a lot of that in Portland.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I know that there was a round of home defense, I guess
we would
call it. Yeah, so folks who were being evicted or whose houses were being repossessed because of unfairly written mortgages. And then the community rallied and actually stood outside and said, no, you will not remove these people from their homes. And that went on for a while. It was pretty inspiring. I think that's one of the things that's so exciting about this Oakland action. And I hesitate to even call it an action, because so often that is just a symbolic thing. And this seems much more realistic and material. Now, maintaining that occupation, of course, is the hard part, but it does seem to come at a time where we are having these conversations about ownership and about how much is too much. We're seeing in Berlin some really great stuff happening with expropriation of properties. So if a company owns more than, I actually don't remember what the number is, so I'm not even going to throw it out there, but a large number of properties, then anything above that number will be taken by the state to be redistributed.
Of course, we can't encourage illegal activity on the air here, but it might be nice to see.
No, but we can encourage public housing, and we can encourage a reinvestment in free housing for folks that need it. And there are a lot of ways that that could happen. And it could happen by companies like Blackstone deciding suddenly that they want to do what's right and give people a little bit more of what they have.
And maybe they could use a little nudge in that direction.
Maybe they could. Well, I mean, it's pretty rare that corporations, the owning class actually decides to give back. And if they do, it's usually just enough to keep us quiet. So I would encourage us to look at other historical methods.
Enough said.
Enough said. Enough said in a radio setting.
Yeah, I remember when, before Occupy, when I was in D.C., there was actually I just remember this. I was involved for a while there. It was actually a little mini tent city on an area that had promised for administration after administration in D.C. had promised that this lot was going to be affordable housing. So people were just sick and tired and just ended up taking it over. It was interesting looking back, because actually before, you know, a year before Occupy happened, and very inspiring. I can't remember what ended up. I have to look into that. But anyway, there's many examples of how people can take matters into our own hands.
And there are a lot of ways to take space. And I think, like, looking at it in different ways is good. because like we have things like, you know, Starbucks, where you can't, I can't go and just sit for 4 hours at a Starbucks without buying something. But
and if you're black.
Oh, yeah. And if you're black, the cops will call the cops, or they will call the cops on you.
But it takes something like that to happen, that happened at Starbucks. Where was that, in Seattle? That someone, or in New York, I can't remember. Anyway, was asked to leave, and it actually led to a change in policy. So again, always direct action gets the goods.
Yeah. Well, but I also think that we can take space in other ways. So it doesn't have to be occupying a house. I think that we see all these corporations buy airtime and buy advertising, so they're all over the landscape. We can take up landscape too. Public art is public art, you know. And I think that there are... I don't want to encourage us to think about it just as taking over buildings, because there are other things that are ours. Public space is for the public. And we are seeing an increase in the amount of premium that money can buy you in those spaces. So when we see things like this, you know, Director's Park conversation happen, this is clearly, and now with the letters that were, the emails that were released yesterday, it is clearly a matter of people thinking that money buys them more rights. And I think we have to push back against that. And I think we can do it in a lot of ways, and we can do it by serving food, and we can do it with public art, and maybe somebody will do it by taking, over an empty building and giving it to a family that needs it. But also, people don't all want to live in houses, and we need to leave space for that. And I love the idea of opening space in public parks for people. In the 30s, there were, you know, camps that were free and run by the people who stayed in them. If anybody's read, Grapes of Wrath, they talk about Grass Valley Camp, which was a real place and was kind of a shining light in the Great Depression for folks who were traveling, for folks who were unhoused, because it was not really government operated. It was just a camp, and it had facilities, and the people who stayed there made the rules, and they did their own community defense, and they did their own cooking and cleaning, and no one had to administer that. And we have a lot of space that we have decided who we try to decide who gets to use. And I think that opening up that conversation, it's about time, and I think it's going
to
happen.
What do you think about this idea that we seem to have a city council that's probably about as open to this conversations we're having here as ever? What do you think about maybe pushing the envelope with such a progressive city council and see how they are willing to, you know, support such efforts?
Well, you know, yeah, there are city council members who have lauded, like, Berlin. I've noticed that you know, Chloe Udely has definitely seen the stuff that's going on there. I know that she has participated in some sort of international, more municipalist conversations. And I would love to see more of that. I do think that there is room at this point for that envelope to open up. And I'd love to see that go as big as possible. Like, eminent domain is a thing that we have leveraged as a city, but only ever for corporations and
freeway
expansion. And a lot of people were hurt by that. And it would be really interesting to see us use that as a tool to put land back in the hands of the people.
Boy, that would be an interesting development.
We need to do that. We need more tiny communities. I'm really interested in helping to start one that is also a cat sanctuary.
Ooh, that sounds great. Who wants to offer
the rats? And those who don't want to help homeless people will be helping animals.
Ah,
there's a hook.
I am going to tell you that the Feral Cat Rescue Project routinely gets more money donated through the Willamette Week Give Guide than Outside In. which is a organization that helps houseless youth. So you are probably on a good track there. And yeah, if anybody has a lot that they would love to see filled with tiny homes and cats,
call us up after the show. 503-231-8032. I'll be on front desk. 503-231-8032. Or do you have some contact info?
You can hit up Portland Assembly on Facebook or Twitter, and I will get that information to Christine because I would love to make that dream happen.
Well, we are running out of time. Any last thoughts, Christine, for leading up to Thanksgiving and what it's like to confront that living
wait,
on
wait.
The streets?
What's your favorite side dish?
I'd have to go with the pumpkin pie.
Okay. Well, how about you, Paul?
Gosh, I'm drawing a blank right now.
It's a tough question. We always make two kinds of potatoes in our house, so I think it's probably potatoes. But, yeah. This year, I
stuffing.
Stuffing. That's a good one too because you never have it any other time.
I do love the green bean casserole.
Oh, my grandmother used to make the one with the cream of mushroom soup. So yeah. So let's look forward to a time where we can all have the Thanksgiving we want and not the one that someone else is going to give us and then tell us to go 5 minutes later.
If my friends can get along with each other, it's going to be a wonderful day.
Thank you for joining us, Christine. And thank you, as always, Sarah. And I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We got to get out of here and leave room for more great programming here on KBOO Community Radio. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you.